Good evening, and welcome to the New York Society for Ethical Culture. My name is Michael Bogdanfi Cree, and I am the president of the Board of Trustees of the Society. While all of you know something about tonight's distinguished guests, I expect ethical culture is a mystery at least to some of you. The New York Society for Ethical Culture was founded over 125 years ago and has been progressive, liberal, and proud of it from the beginning. Among our outstanding achievements are the founding of the Visiting Nurse Service and the Ethical Culture Fieldston Schools. We joined with others to establish the NAACP, the ACLU, the Legal Aid Society, and the New York Committee to Abolish Capital Punishment. Our members have a long-standing tradition of advocacy on civil liberties and human rights issues. We are humanists. We place our faith in a demonstrated capacity of people to do wonderful things. We believe in the worth and dignity of all living beings and seek to respect and protect it. Our conviction is that we must conduct ourselves and the business of our institutions in such a way that we bring out the best in and for all. As a community, we stand for the separation of church and state. We stand for a woman's right to choose. And we stand against the death penalty. Among the commitments that we ethical culturists make to ourselves and the world in general is to be continuously questioning and continuously learning. We are proud to present programs like tonight's, and we are particularly pleased to be teaming up with WBAI to raise money to continue this kind of thought-provoking public programming.
Guantanamo Bay, Haditha, Hamandia, Ishaki, Fallujah. This is why it is so important that we gather here tonight in this sanctuary of dissent. I wanted to quote for a moment from Newsweek. That's right, Newsweek. First paragraph last week. The Marines know how to get psyched up for a big fight. In November 2004, before the Battle of Fallujah, the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, better known as the 3-1 or Thundering 3rd, held a chariot race. Horses had been confiscated from suspected insurgents, and charioteers were urged to go all out. The men of Kilo Company, honored to be first into the city on that day of the battle, wore togas and cardboard helmets and hoisted a shield emblazoned with a large K. As speakers blasted a heavy metal song, "Come on, feel the noise," the warriors of Kilo Company carried homemade mace and a ball and chain studded with M16 bullets. A company captain intoned a line from a scene in the movie Gladiator, in which the Romans prepare to slaughter the barbarians. "What you do here echoes in eternity," the quote from the film. That's the lead paragraph from an article in this past week's issue of Newsweek magazine. The article goes on to say that Kilo Company arrived in Haditha in the fall of 2005, which is why it's so important to take on these stories, to take on these massacres, because violence breeds violence if they aren't each dealt with. And of course, we can go back before Fallujah. We can go back to the invasion of Iraq. Just before coming here, we had CNN on, and Wolf Blitzer was interviewing Mr. Rasool, one of the three, the Tipton Three, one of the men who was released from Guantanamo, and they're suing the U.S. government for torture. When talking about Rasool, they said he says he was at Guantanamo. When Ray McGovern challenged Rumsfeld in Atlanta, the former CIA analyst who who was with the agency for more than a quarter of a century, was one of Vice President George H.W. Bush's top daily briefers. When he challenged Rumsfeld in the way that reporters should be doing on a daily basis at the Pentagon briefings, CNN referred to him in the same way, who claims he worked for the CIA. Claims, alleged, these are very important words. Why not use them leading up to the invasion when it came to weapons of mass destruction? To use these words when referring to dissidents, but referring to those in power, taking them at their word. Well, I.F. Stone, the great journalist, you know, when talking to young journalism students, just remember two words. Governments lie, he said. It's a basic principle, at least not to be cynical, but to be skeptical. And I think the people that are going to be speaking tonight certainly live up to that. Absolutely critical, both working in the mainstream media, working within the establishment, yet key voices of dissent within their different media. We're going to begin tonight with Paul Krugman, who is a New York Times op-ed columnist, a breath of fresh air on that back page of the front section, author of The Great Unraveling, and also author of Principles of Economics, Paul Krugman.
I'm as passionate, I think, about the issues that Amy was talking about as she is, but we are to talk about class warfare and inequality, and I will try to stay with that, although I'm sure other things will come up later. I want to give you a little perspective. I'm actually trying in work I'm now beginning. I'm just in the very early stages of a book, but I'm trying to figure out, you know, what is it that happened to us as a country? This long arc, how did we get here? Because we are a very different country from the one I grew up in, from the one that many of the people in this audience grew up in. And it didn't. A lot of things have become more visible since George Bush was installed in the White House, but it didn't start there. There's this great sweep of history trying to understand what happened, and a lot of it has to do with questions of inequality of class. There's a great transformation that's happened, and let me tell you. I want to read you a few lines from if Amy can quote Newsweek, I can read from Time magazine. Whose most liberal columnist is Joe Klein. Anyway, to go back to, I was actually trying to get a sense. I've been working with statistics, but I was trying to get a sense of what this America that we seem to have lost was like. And been going back and reading. Now, Time magazine had a kind of survey of just, you know, what is the country like in 1953 after the election of Dwight Eisenhower. And what they said, and the article began, even in the smallest towns and most isolated areas, the U.S. is wearing a very prosperous middle-class suit of clothes and an attitude of relaxation and confidence. People are not growing wealthy, but more of them than ever before are getting along. Now, that wasn't really fair, even in 1953. Certainly, if you were had the wrong skin color, if you were living in the wrong parts of the country, you wouldn't have agreed with that picture. But it was true of a lot of people. In fact, America really was a middle-class society during the 50s and the 60s. Not everyone, not large segments of the population, but it was a relatively middle-class society, a relatively even distribution. And there were not a lot of very wealthy people either. And it's not just that more people than ever before had a decent standard of living, but that the extremes, the plutocracy, seemed to have been pretty much tamed and to a large extent eliminated. You would never say that about the country now. You would say, gee, this isn't, we are now a country of great extremes. We're a country in which more and more people are having a hard time maintaining the essentials of a middle class existence. To say, just to take the cutting edge of the degeneration, health insurance. More and more people losing that sort of basic security of life, job assurance. If you look at the long sweep, here's what you see about America. Once upon a time, there was the Gilded Age, period of enormous wealth, plutocracy. That lasted a lot longer than the history books would tell you. The Gilded Age is usually thought of as something that ended, and you know, once intellectuals began speaking about changing it, but it didn't, of course. It was really pretty much in place. All that wealth and privilege and widespread poverty and enormous gaps lasted right up into the 1930s. There was really, as far as we can tell, there was really no difference in the amount of inequality in 1929 from what it had been in the pre-World War I period. Then we became a middle-class society. We became a society that the one that, again, with allowing for Time magazine sort of missing a lot of people in that story, we became that relatively broadly based prosperity, which is the country I grew up in. And then we became, again, a dramatically unequal, class-ridden society. And if you look at the numbers and also at just look around you, we are really back in all essential respects to Gilded Age levels of class differences and barriers. I do like my statistics, but I also like the impressionistic things. And one of the things I've always tended to look at is real estate, specifically how ordinary people live, but also how the wealthy live. And if you were to go back, the shores of Long Island Sound are a good place to sort of catch an index of what's happening. In the Gilded Age and up through the 20s into the 30s, the shores of Long Island Sound, both the North Shore of Long Island and the Connecticut coast, were where the super wealthy built their mansions. They were gigantic piles, huge things where people lived. By the time I was growing up, the mansions, most of them were still there physically, but they were no longer private mansions. People couldn't afford them. They were between a really serious diminution of the wealth of the wealthiest, taxes, income taxes, lower incomes, the estate taxes, and the fact that also Americans were too well paid to be hired as servants to maintain those things. Most of them had been given up. They'd been sold for very little to become schools and nursing homes, or they'd actually been given away and become museums or government buildings. Today, well, there was a story, actually. The current Vanity Fair, interesting thing how sometimes the best reporting is not coming sort of, you know, from the Washington Post, but from magazines. The story, which is actually mostly prurient interest, but it's pretty interesting anyway, about Greenwich, Connecticut, where there are still a lot of the old Gilded Age mansions there. And it turns out that what's been happening in Greenwich is that hedge fund managers have been buying up the Gilded Age mansions and knocking them down to build much bigger residences. The typical ones that they're describing now are about 30,000 plus square feet, which is about the size of the Taj Mahal. So that's the impressionistic thing. In terms of the numbers, just to say, and this can easily become a grind, but it's worth saying, the important thing to realize about what's happened to America, both the flattening of our income distribution that happened in the middle of the century and the widening out that's happened again, is it's not a story about the top quarter of the population pulling ahead or the top 15%. The great bulk of the action is really a few percent, in many cases, just a very, very small number of people. If you were to look at there's been a large rise since the 1970s in the share of income that's gone to the top 10% of the population. I've gone through that, and if you work it out, it turns out that most of that rise is actually the top 1% of the population, and about half of it is the top quarter of a percent of the population, which means at the moment, or actually 2003, which is the last date for which we have it, people with incomes of more than $750,000 a year. So we're really not talking about, you'll hear stories that say, well, people with good education and skills are pulling away from the rest of the population. Well, it's true that by and large, people who are earning $750,000 or more a year have college educations, but not everybody, right? It's like I like to say, the Fortune 500 CEOs and high school teachers have got, on average, about the same number of years of education. They're not exactly experiencing the same pay raises. So there's this tremendous elitism. Now, why does all of this matter? It matters because, partly because it just means that, most people are not sharing in economic growth. And the standard of living of the typical American family is, well, is it higher or lower than it was 30 years ago? You know, we can ask that question, but the fact that you even have to ask is telling you something. It's close enough. Consumption of material goods seems a little bit higher, but job security is clearly a lot less. People are working longer hours. The risk of losing health insurance is much greater. The difficulty of getting your kids into a decent school is much harder. So it's a mixed picture, but certainly not. If you'd asked in 1973, are people better off than they were in 1947, people would have had, there was no question, enormous progress. If you ask that now about 30 years ago, it's not at all clear what the answer is. It's only the top few percent of the population that have had an enormous gain. So that's one thing. We've had economic growth, but it hasn't been broadly shared. But I actually think that that's almost the least of it. Much more important is what this polarization of incomes does to our society. And there's part of it that I can't document too well, but I'm working on, which is I think it actually just poisons the feeling of our society. And there's a reasonable amount of evidence that having a highly unequal society undermines the trust that people have in each other, because they don't believe that we're all in the same boat, that it actually increases corruption. One of the, as you know, John Kenneth Galbraith died recently, I've been reading his book, The New Industrial State, which was a fantastic portrait of the way American capitalism was in the 60s, but he thought it would persist forever, and it didn't. And one of the things he says there at length is that the whole issue that, you know, corporate executives might engage in self-dealing, that they might enrich themselves at the expense of the corporation, it's just nothing to worry about. There's no problem on that. And that was probably true around 1967. You ask, why has that changed? And one of the answers is, well, you know, in the days when executives were paid like government officials, the incentive to lie and cheat, you know, you might get yourself a promotion, a bit larger salary, but if you were caught, that was the end of your career. Now, if you lie and cheat, you can walk off with a couple of $100 million after a couple of years. And if you are then booted from the company, you can probably find a way to not, unless you are really, really stupid, you won't get convicted by a jury. You know, Ken Lay, okay, but Richard Scrooge walked away. And you're set. So the incentives, the inequality in itself creates the possibility of corruption in a way that wasn't there before. And there's the political process. Let me tell you a historical story I've been working on quite a lot. Before the New Deal, there was a movement, there was an attempt to, there was a progressive movement. People did try for reform. And the great reformist of the time was Al Smith, the governor of New York, who was a poor kid who made his way up and retained, at least for a while, his feeling for the kind of people he grew up with. And ran a very serious campaign for reform, for what would have been a sort of proto-New Deal policy in 1928. And it was, at that point, one of the ugliest campaigns ever in American history. Now, I mean, the trouble was that basically most people would have stood to benefit from the kinds of things Al Smith was advocating. So what was the Republican Party, which at that time, by the way, the Republican Party had fundraising offices in every state, plus one for the North Shore of Long Island, where there were 500 mansions, just to give you a sense of how things worked, who ran the party. Well, they had to find something, so what they found was that he was he was an Irish Catholic. And so there was this horrifying smear of cultural fears campaign against Al Smith, with burning crosses and everything, that managed to swing a number of southern states, which, being relatively poor, actually would have stood to gain quite a lot from his policies, that turned a lot of those states against him. And so they were able to exploit, cultural divisions. But although fundamentally, there's no evidence that the people who were actually running, this is Herbert Hoover's campaign, there's no evidence that Herbert Hoover was himself a violent anti-Catholic bigot or that the people running his campaigns were, but they had found an issue that they could use to sort of... Does this all sound kind of familiar? And I think that's true. Now, what I can say for sure, and actually some of my colleagues at Princeton in the politics department work on... have done very interesting work on politics. And what they show is that the polarization of politics, you could measure. And I would say the nastiness, which is very, they can't exactly measure, but is very closely correlated, is very much, it rises and falls with income inequality. Periods, the Gilded Age, the 20s, were periods of, you know, grotesque abuse of cultural issues, anything, to smear people who might suggest things like, you know, progressive taxation. And times when those kinds of views, when everyone had more or less accepted the existence of the New Deal institutions, were quite calm. So that same Time magazine article in 1953 is saying, you know, Republicans and Democrats have a surprising sameness of outlook and political thinking, and that makes a big point about how Eisenhower had made it clear that he was not going to try to roll back the New Deal. Well, that's why we. That's a consequence of being a relatively equal society. And the ugliness and the viciousness of our political scene right now, I think, are in fact largely a consequence of the gross inequalities that have emerged. Why? How did we, what happened? There's a tendency to say, well, it's, you know, it's these impersonal market forces, or maybe it's globalization requires inequality, or just technology. There's always some truth to that kind of thing, but much less than you might imagine. I've already mentioned a little bit about education. We keep on hearing that technology creates this premium for education, for the creative classes, whatever it might be. Turns out that that's really, well, put it this way, the median college-educated American has, unlike the median non-college-educated American, actually seen some gains in income over the past 25 years, but they're tiny. Was less than 1% a year on average, and in fact, over the past 5 years, most college-educated workers have actually seen their incomes fall once you adjust for inflation. It's not actually true that a college education is the key to being successful. It's being part of the tiny magic circle of the economic elite that gets you ahead. So it really isn't about education. It isn't about skills. A little bit of it is about, you know, we like to talk about human capital being what matters. If you actually look at the last 5 years, human capital has been losing, but good old capital has actually been doing extremely well. Share of profits in national income is at its highest level since 1929. But it's at least that particular impersonal market force. And a lot of it looks like it's, in fact, it's the political process does a lot to drive the distribution of income. Partly, of course, taxes. Taxes which tax the rich and provide benefits to everyone at large, but also other things. Whether you have a political environment that basically assures workers of the right to organize, or one that basically is sympathetic with employers who try to break unions. Whether you have a general set of political pressure that says that fairness is a good thing, or that says that greed is good. And just to... on my historical thing, this middle-class society that we had in the 50s and 60s and part of the 70s, the one I grew up in, you know, I was taught that this is the natural place. Economic growth brings you there as an advanced society. And, of course, it turned out that it was only a resting point. But when you look back at how we got that middle-class society, it did not evolve gradually over a century or something. It was actually created in a very short period of time. As far as we can tell, in 1935, although the robber barons weren't doing too well because corporate America as a whole was losing money, basically the Gilded Age was still in full place. By 1945, we were a middle-class society. It was created in a very short period of time, and it was created through political leadership, created through a union movement which went from insignificance to being a very powerful force in American society, created by a change in attitudes. And to a large extent, I believe, but they were still trying to figure out exactly how all the channels, to a large extent, this inequality that we now have is created, or at least it's a result of the demolition of the institutions that created that middle-class society. which tells you that there's a kind of a circular process. We know that that high inequality tends to create a political movement that tries to buttress the position of the economic elite. And we know that politics has a strong impact on the degree of inequality. And we appear to be in a kind of spiral right now in which the growing power of an economic elite is leading to policies that reinforce the economic position of that elite. So that also says it's reversible. And all we need is another FDR. And if you see one, let me know about him. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. And thank you to WBAI and the Ethical Culture Society tonight for sponsoring tonight's event. So let's see, we've quoted Newsweek, we've quoted Time. I thought it's time to quote Pacifica Radio. They call him the Sid Vicious of investigative journalism. Catherine Harris calls him twisted and maniacal. In England, though, Tribune magazine calls him the most important investigative reporter of our time. BBC television reporter Greg Palast is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Greg also has another less well-known side, his lectures on corporate government at the University of Cambridge School of Applied Economics have been compiled into a treatise, Regulation and Democracy, A Guide for Governments. It's published by the United Nations. Well, tonight, Greg Palast launches his new book in New York City. It's called Armed Madhouse, and see if you can hold your breath through the subtitle, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child's Behind Left, and Other Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War. Finally, the Baltimore Chronicle has this to say about Greg Palast. No one has investigated the Bush clan like Greg Palast and lived to write about it. Greg Palast.
A big up for Amy Goodman, our weapon of mass instruction. Democracy Now, Not Later. A big thanks and our gratitude to truth teller Paul Krugman. And we will be joined, by the way, as soon as your program is over, by the anti-Limbaugh. Randy Rhodes will be arriving here. Randy. And I want especially to thank the crack in the electronic Berlin Wall, Ground Zero Radio, WBAI, in New York City. I'll show you what class war looks like. Here's CNN's balls. Ever take a look at this? Is from November 3rd of 2004, 1 a.m. in the morning. John Kerry won among men, it says on the exit polls, by 51% to 49%, but John Kerry won among women, 53% to 47%. All right, class, if you weren't left behind, what's the third sex that put Bush over the top in Ohio? Well, I'm a reporter for BBC Television. I do investigative reporting, which, of course, you can't do here. It's illegal under Patriot Act 3. And so I do it from Britain. And so I was reporting the news. I was reporting about the elections, and I announced the results. Kerry won. And then I had explained he won't be inaugurated. But I did get a call. I really did that week from the paper of record, from Paul's employer. Bless him for sticking it out. They called me and they said, you wrote that in the Guardian papers. I had George Orwell's little column. I said, he'll like this. You wrote that John Kerry won. And so we're investigating this matter. Could you? And I said, yeah, actually, that's based on 4 years of a large team investigation. And they said, well, okay, we're investigating too. We'd like to ask you some questions. I said, shoot, question one, are you a sore loser? Question two, are you a conspiracy nut? Question three, there was no question three. End of the paper of record investigation. Next day, I'm not kidding you, front page of the Times. Internet theories of Bush loss spread by blogs, easily debunked. BBC didn't think it was so easily debunked. They wanted the material, so I'll tell you something. You just read in Rolling Stone RFK's article that John, you know, we know that officially, Kenneth Blackwell announced that John Kerry lost to George Bush by 118,000 votes in Ohio. That's pretty impressive if you don't count the 250,000 votes that no one got to. But you know, we talk about Florida, Florida, Ohio, Ohio, but around, surrounding Ohio is a place called America. And in America, 3,600,000, 380 votes were cast, ballots cast, and never counted. Not in Ukraine, not in Uganda, in the United States of America. Now, where did I get this from? You know, I mean, from the black helicopter? No, from the Election Information Agency in the United States Census Bureau, which I should explain to the New York Times reporters not used to this, rule of investigative reporting one, written by that journalist Yogi Berra. It's amazing what you can see when you look. Okay, 3 million ballots. What happened? 1,389,231 of them, a million and change, were spoiled. How do you spoil a vote? You leave it out of the fridge? Okay, old joke. No, they're glitches, you know. Hanging Chad still hanging around, mostly in Ohio. Touch screen machines that just don't feel you know how to touch them anymore. Okay. But who gets glitched? I wish I didn't know statistics, because I wouldn't have found this. I went into the rotting dumpster of spoiled votes with U.S. Civil Rights Commission statisticians, myself, and statisticians from Cleveland State. And we counted the ballots spoiled in the white majority precincts, that little lozenge, white lozenge you see there. And then we looked at the black precincts, and you see that big, thick black line. If you are an African-American, the chance your vote will spoil or not get counted or rejected in the United States is 900% higher than if you're a white voter, 500% higher if you're Hispanic than a white voter to lose your vote. If you're Native American, this is not minor, the chance that your vote will spoil is 2,000% or more higher than if you're a pale-faced voter. Do the arithmetic. You know, you remember high school arithmetic, 900x times 500y, et cetera. 88% of the votes chucked in the electoral bin are cast by voters of color. 88%, almost 9 out of 10. You do the arithmetic, tell me one. Now, cast not counted. Now, I told you about the million or so that were spoiled. Then there's the just perfectly readable but rejected. 1,090,000 rejected provisional ballots. Now, how did that happen? A million votes just rejected, cast rejected. Because those voters were challenged and their votes were thrown away. Challenged. It was the biggest, 2004, unreported, was the biggest mass challenge of voters in the United States of America since the era of Jim Crow. How did they do it? Well, if you remember my story from 2000, in which Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris, just before the 2000 election, purged up to 94,000 voters. Well, because they were criminals, not allowed to vote, except their only crime when I cracked their computer disks was their only crime was voting while black. That was the election. You read that in the Times. Actually, you did. They printed it in 2004. To tell you everything was all right. Well, it was fixed, but not in the way that they said, because Jeb Bush secretly ordered another purge, and the purge spread nationwide. Well, these criminals shouldn't be allowed to vote, like the dangerous Bernice Kynes, my staff found, we got the list, she was purged in 2004 because she was convicted of a felony on July 31st, 2009. Dangerous. Look out for Bernice. How did it get so big? But they, felons is just practice. How did they get millions? 3 million voters were shunted to provisional ballots. 3 million. I don't know how they did it. Until this came into my mailbox, email box. My email box at, you know, at that we were working with georgewbush.org. Shouldn't have done that. We got our team. Ended up receiving lists, names and addresses of voters, from Tim Griffin, the top guy, the top operative of the Republican National Committee and chief of research, lists going to the state party chairman. Now, what are they doing with this clerical stuff? What is this stuff? And why at the top level? And why was it secret? And they said, here's another caging list, here's another caging list. We got another caging list. What's a caging list? So BBC sent me to ask the Republicans, you lose something? So all these top guys are getting it. So what could this be? So I went to the BBC sent me to the Republican National Committee and to the state chairman. We said, what's this? And they said, donor lists. I said, well, this page is the Jacksonville State Street Rescue Mission. Get a lot of men vote, you know, donors out of the men's shelters. Try again. Our team went through it. We had like 70,000 names from one state matching the demographics to the precincts. This was a lot of work, and 98% of the names, 98% of the names were African American voters. 98%. This was a challenge list. People with suspect addresses. By the way, the other 2% were in retirement communities of Jewish voters in Miami, a democratic demographic. They were going after the elderly of Zion, see? And so why didn't they fess up and say, look, these people are illegal voters. They are voting from an improper address. I'll tell you why. It's against the law, okay? It's a felony to target voters for a challenge, even if you have grounds for it. If ethnicity, race, religion is part of your calculation, 98% African-American, 2% Jewish. You tell me, okay? Who are these suspect voters? Hey, if they're illegal voters, I'm not going to stand up and defend it. Who are they? Here's one sheet. It's in the book. Address, Naval Air Station, 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 all the way down page after page after page after page after page of African American soldiers, sailors, seamen. Those are suspect voters. How are they being challenged? The Republican National Committee, I don't even have this in the book, this is new today. I was trying to figure out the mechanism. They sent millions of first-class letters. This thing was expensive. Millions of first-class letters to these voters that they had targeted by race. And wrote, do not forward. So when we called one, my staff called one, Randy Prouse's house. His wife answered. We said, where's Randy using this address? And she said, well, he's been shipped overseas. What happened was that the letters then went to these soldiers shipped overseas with a do not forward. The letters came back. The Republican Party state chairman passed it down to elections officials and said, these are suspect voters. When their vote comes in, they are challenged. Go to Baghdad, lose your vote. Just by the way, for your information, it is legal for a soldier to vote for President of the United States from under a tank, from under a Humvee in Fallujah. Okay? Even if they're a black soldier, it's legal. But I can tell you one thing about being challenged. Okay? It's very easy to fight George Bush's war when you're in Baghdad, but it's very hard to fight for your ballot from Baghdad. Okay? Now, why were these, and by the way, see, race is the badge of poverty in America, the color, but it's not the indicator. We went through the statistics. You want to know who doesn't get to vote? It's income. There's no greater measure. We used to have, in the United States, a rule that you had to be a propertied landed gentry to vote. Now we kind of have a sliding scale of income. Look at these numbers. 3.6 million votes not counted, doubled from 2000. Look out for 2008. And who are these suspect? Why were these suspect voters there in Fallujah? Now I know that out there are conspiracy nuts who believe that George Bush had a secret plan to seize the oil fields of Iraq before the tanks rolled, before September 11th. That's not true. We investigated. He actually had two plans, and I've got them both. We put them on television. Yeah, you saw that on Fox News, right? And we put on the top of the BBC Nightly News. Now, the first plan, this one here, this is a page out of a 101-page plan, was developed by, as it turns out, we did some investigating, it was developed by that military strategist, military genius, Grover Norquist. He's kind of the capo, if you don't know who he is, he's the capo to copy of corporate lobbyists on K Street in Washington, works with Microsoft and the NRA, Christian Coalition's partners, Jack Abramoff, good guys to plan our invasion. Did one thing that you'll be happy to know is that there was, you know, he did represent Microsoft, and there is in the occupation plan a provision to change the copyright laws of Iraq. So you will no longer be threatened by illegal dubs of Britney Spears' Baby Just One More Time. And of course, Microsoft won't be threatened with illegal dubs of Windows. Now the second plan where's the oil? In fact, it actually did say in that plan, I should say, it says in there at page 73 that they're going to privatize, that is, sell off all state assets, especially those in the oil and supporting industries. There it is. And by the way, look in the book, we really do have the original announcement of the invasion when it was called Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL. Then it was changed to OIF, Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom. But there it is, right? Blood for oil. And, you know, we all protested, no blood for oil, no blood for oil. We got to change that slogan, guys, because a lot of Americans think blood for oil is a bargain. And, you know, it's just, if it's not your blood, it's just, you know, suspected voters, right? Suspect voters. But then a second plan came into effect, because they didn't. They changed the copyright laws of Iraq. That was done by Paul Bremer, whose qualifications for being our pasha, our viceroy in Iraq, was that he was Henry Kissinger's managing director of Kissinger Associates. But we didn't privatize the oil fields. Why not? Because there was a second plan second plan. And it's called, it's, well, I don't know if I can show it to you because it says maintain the contents confidential. You have to understand, when I got the documents from the Republican Party, I was just questioned on NPR, and they said, you know, at NPR, we don't do that. I said, I know that. Anyway, I got this one, and I'll show it to you anyway, what the heck. It's 323 pages long, which the government absolutely denied, just so you know. I don't want you to think that this document exists, it's 323 pages long, and you don't see it, because the government has said in writing, Defense Department, State Department, Treasury, White House said, in writing to BBC, it doesn't exist. Now, how do we find out about it? Well, I smelled Baker. James Baker. Not Baker. Not Baker like a guy who bakes your muffins, but Baker the Third, who is the lawyer for ExxonMobil Corporation, the consigliere for the Bush family and the Republican Party, senior counsel to Carlyle Group. And also, as you know, families of the victims of September 11th have sued Saudi Arabia for funding Al-Qaeda because, you know, Osama didn't put the attack on his credit card. The money came from the Arabian Peninsula. And what happened was the families sued the Saudi Arabian government. And they sued the Saudi Arabian government. The families of the victims of September 11th. And that case is so important that the president gave the lawyer in that case an office in the White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, James Baker III, who represents the Saudi government against the victims. Just, you know, he really does have an office at 1600. In fact, when I called the White House to confirm this, they said, yeah, and sometimes Baker uses the Oval Office desk while the president plays on the rug. Which, now... No, that's not true. But he does have an office, really does, at 1600 Pennsylvania. But what was he doing there? Now, it doesn't say that this plan was crafted, by the way. It does, by the way, it says it's a plan for developing a long-term sustainable Iraqi oil industry. Now, you'd think that a long-term Iraqi oil industry plan would be planned by Iraqis, but you don't understand democracy. Now, so I don't know that Baker's team was involved, and the oil industry executives. Well, I talked to many, including the former head of Shell Oil and the CEO, Baker's people, oil executives. Now, I do want to warn you that they said that I never spoke to them. Okay. In fact, their lawyers threatened to sue Harper's Magazine, which published the BBC story in the United States. And their lawyers called Harper's, and Lewis Lapham, the editor, said, which part of this audio tape is not you? and the NPR reporter said, we don't do that at NPR. I said, I know. What was the heart of the plan? It wasn't to get the oil. It wasn't blood for oil. That's not what they wanted. They wanted this. It says that they wanted to, here's the key, enhance the Iraqi government's relationship with OPEC. Enhance the government's relationship with OPEC. And what does that mean? I mean, OPEC is the oil cartel run by the Saudis, which sets quotas and squeezes the supply of oil. How do you enhance your relationship with OPEC? You enhance your relationship with your wife, you give her flowers, you enhance your relationship with your Lord by prayer. How do you enhance your relationship with an oil cartel? Okay. All right. Let me give you, and Paul can do this better than me, so I'll give it to you in simple terms. If the supply of oil is low, the price of oil is high. And the second economic rule of the petroleum industry is if the supply of oil is low, the price of oil is high. Okay. Now, throughout this plan, the key thing was setting up an arrangement whereby Iraq would never, ever break its quota limit of 3 million barrels. Now it has nearly as much oil in the ground as Saudi Arabia, but it would never break a quota which is one-third, one-fourth of Saudi Arabia's. The less supply, the higher the price. Okay? Now, if you think that Mr. Bush screwed up in Iraq when he left, when Bill Clinton left office, oil was, you know, bouncing around $20 a barrel, cheaper than peanut butter. And when today, look in the paper, it's $73 a barrel. Mission accomplished. Okay. All right. And by the way, I'll speed up here because so to make a long story short, that's why they have to kill Hugo Chavez. But let me show you this. This is from the Department of Energy. We showed this, by the way, on BBC also. And the Department of Energy called London and said, where did you get that document? We said, we don't remember. Anyway, but they now have made it public. It's what this is. You see this big old peak. See, there's a bump down near the bottom. That's how much oil we're getting about now from Saudi Arabia and the reserves we have now. Then it says, if we add in Orinoco, extra heavy oil resources. The Orinoco is in Venezuela. If we add in Venezuela's oil, we note that Venezuela has 5 times as much oil as Saudi Arabia. And that's a problem because the oil is underneath Venezuela, which is underneath Hugo Chavez. Okay. Now, but why is that a problem? Why is that a problem? It's a problem. You know, what happens when you see, now we'll do a little, dip a little more into the class economics. You watch the president ferry King Abdullah around in his golf cart on the Crawford Ranch. Now, why does he do that? Well, partly because he's afraid of horses. Now, that I didn't make up. We have checked the files. There's one single photo, I kid you not, of George Bush on a horse, and the horse is dead. It's a stuffed horse. You pull back, and it's, you know, I'm not kidding. So besides being afraid of horse, why carry Abdullah around, right? You know, I mean, by the way, it's kind of interesting because cartels, of which Abdullah is the leader, are illegal operations. They are, if an American is involved, like James Baker trying to enhance OPEC, not that he did such a thing, but that's against the law. But there is an exception called sovereign immunity for criminal cartel operatives who wear bathrobes and crowns. Okay, so why are we with this guy? Now, it's not that George Bush needs Abdullah's oil. Abdullah can't drink it. His harem can't drink it. He'll sell it to us or the Japanese, wherever. Okay. Let me go back to another economics lesson. If you saw the film Network, right? And there was a truth-telling journalist who said, we're not going to take it anymore. And he's hauled into a corporate boardroom by a mogul, a Rupert Murdoch-ish mogul, who's also an industrialist. And he says to the journalist Beale, he says, Mr. Beale, the Arabs have taken billions of dollars from us, and now we must get it back. That is the ebb and flow. That is the tidal gravity. And you're concerned about nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no borders. There are no peoples. There is only the ebb and the flow. The money goes out and it comes in and it goes out. And it must come back in. And Hugo Chavez said, I don't think so. And that's what's happening. We are paying right now